This area, New York, once called New Amsterdam by its early Dutch settlers and Lenapehoking by its native Algonquin peoples, is overflowing with its own half-buried past. The subway tunnels are nearly unnavigable, flooded by 1,000 overlapping adventures. Should you, in your travels, zoom by the Lorimer stop on the L under Williamsburg, look closely at the swiftly passing platform and you'll see a young woman waiting, hair disheveled, makeup smeared. It's you, during those 6 weeks when you would stumble home from Sean's apartment at 3 o'clock in the morning, high heels in hand, just because you didn't want to be one of those girls who spent the night. The town is full of these triggers, and the longer you live here, the more landmines you set. There's the Gap at Astor Place, the bathroom at the Crocodile Lounge. The odds of stumbling into the lingering smoke of an old flame are staggering, and increasing still with every new significant instance spent with another significant other. But of all the tributes to the fallen heroes and tragic victims of your fickle heart, a list as long and exhausting as a full avenue block, there remains one place more than any other you know you can never return to. You know where it is, and you go out of your way not to see it, to not be reminded of the thing that happened there. It's too much, this place. It would swallow you whole, this void, this pit, this unassuming two-story brownstone in Carroll Gardens that houses the one-bedroom apartment a much younger you and the man now listed in your phone as do not call him were ever so foolish as to refer to as home. Sometimes you imagine do not call him also not going there. You picture the two of you both not going there at the same time and not meeting each other outside on the sidewalk, you not taking the opportunity to tell him all the ways he wronged you, not explaining that even though you were over it now, so over it, you just wanted to make sure he didn't try that shit again with the next girl for her sake. Because you're such a fucking humanitarian, he would not say, and you would wonder why you'd bother to not meet up with him in the first place. And then there's the Bronx, which is where people decide to get married, specifically the zoo part of the Bronx, specifically the part of the zoo that's in front of the monkey house, and specifically your grandparents who visited the Bronx Zoo monkey house after 6 weeks of courtship and decided to get married. How did you make such a big decision after 6 weeks? You once asked your grandmother. You barely even knew each other. In those days, people didn't drag their feet so much. If you loved someone, you married him. But how did you know? It was easy, she replied. I asked your grandfather. Do you think we should get married? And he said, let's ask the monkeys. Hey, monkeys, you think we should get married? And the monkeys were laughing, and he said, I think that's a yes. That's it? You got married because the monkeys were laughing? Your grandmother shrugged. I thought it was a sign. You took Alex to the Bronx Zoo once, or was it Anthony, to see if the primates might make some magic for you, but the monkey house was gone. It had been torn down in 2012. You decided that was a sign. In Astoria, Queens, sits a small studio apartment in which Carlos, love of your life for the moment, puts together his applications for grad school. During slow days at work or long rides on the N, you'll catch yourself daydreaming about Carlos getting accepted somewhere, and you following him far, far away. You imagine spending the rest of your life with this man, as you've imagined with all of them, not because you think you will, necessarily, but just because you can't help but wonder. You imagine the kids you'll have, the family vacations and anniversary dinners, the way you'll help each other with the dishes, the way you'll interrupt and editorialize each other's stories and jokes, the way you'll promise to never go to bed angry, even if that means, as it often will, staying up all night arguing. But mostly, you imagine living somewhere else, miles and miles from this cramped and crowded, once-thriving capital of the 20th century. You could live in Austin, you think, or Minneapolis. You hear Seattle is gorgeous, and you've never even been. One morning, over breakfast and tea and the weekend Seattle Times in your spacious new downtown loft or whatever kind of apartment people get in Seattle, Carlos will smile at you, and you'll smile at him, and he'll scratch the back of his head in that shaggy Carlos way of his, and he'll say, hey, why don't we plan a trip to New York sometime? We can see a Broadway show, catch up with old friends. Carlos will clear the two cereal bowls, part of the brand new set you bought when you moved here, and on the way to the sink, he'll kiss you gently on the forehead. The very forehead that's been so gently kissed by so many men, a marker amid thousands in a graveyard of kisses. And you'll smile at this man and wonder if he too, like all those who came before him, will someday be a bittersweet memory. Will someday be felled by the same foolish blunder of knowing you a little too well, and yet also somehow not enough. What do you say? You want to go back to New York? See the sights? No, you'll say. There are too many ghosts there.
We Men of Science, read by James Urbaniak. My wife was 11 months pregnant at the time. which always seemed to me an awful lot of months to be pregnant. "Is that normal?" I would say. And Jessica would say, "The doctor says it's normal." And I would say, "I don't think it is." And she would say, "Are you a doctor, Yanni?" And then I would say, "Yeah, I am, actually." "So are you. Technically, we are both doctors." And she would say, "Can we drop it?" I earned my doctorate in aerospace engineering, but my real passion was always molecular biophysics. When I took the call from my friend and mentor, Dr. Carl Hesslein, I was in the middle of giving a lecture on the philosophy of science to a sparsely attended class of lazy sophomores who'd hoped my course might be an easy way to knock out a gen ed requirement at a mostly uninspiring and forgettable university. I don't mean to be rude about the school in question, or its student body. Those are just true statements. "First, the good news," I said. "We're doomed. Our planet is dying. Our universe is dying. Our friends, our family, everyone we've ever known, everyone we ever will know, all our distant progeny who are thousands of generations away from even being born, all of us are slowly, slowly dying, dying, dying." And then I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say good news?" At this point, my lecture notes instructed me to pause for laughter. Nobody laughed. I paused anyway. "But there is good news," I continued. "And that is this. Science will live on after we're all dead. Science will survive, with or without our attempts to understand it. Science doesn't care. Like a callous ex-lover, science won't miss you. And sure, maybe that's a little scary. But isn't it also exciting?" My cell phone rang. I knew immediately it was Dr. Hesslein because of the ringtone. Beethoven's lush and haunting Vienna on my mind. I answered the phone. "Dr. Hesslein, I'm in class right now." The students continued to type into their laptops and phones. I entertained the idea that they were now taking notes on my personal phone call, but Occam's razor would suggest that they had never really been taking notes at all. Carl spoke quickly in overlapping fragments, as if he, like science, had no particular desire to be understood. "Yanni, the grant, the board, under the direction of, was established. It's happening. I can't even. It's happening." The it that was happening was the anti-door, a project he and I had both spent the majority of our adult lives daydreaming about, all of a sudden becoming a reality, thanks to a generous grant from the Frank and Felicity Fielding Foundation. I first became interested in Carl's research several years earlier, after I witnessed something terrible on the metro. I was reading Milton Hilton's new book. It was a meditation on particle velocity levels, nothing revolutionary. Suddenly, very loudly, I heard something terrible happening. "No, please don't." I didn't look up. "Help," I heard. And then, just in case I hadn't heard, "Please, help me, please." I tried not to listen. I focused on the words in my book. I read the same paragraph over and over again. This is what it said. "Particles. Particles. Everywhere. Particles. Also, Deborah, I love you. Will you marry me?" For dinner, Jessica and I had Chinese. My wife didn't like to cook. I say that like she should, like it's her job. Excuse me, neither of us like to cook. We got takeout a lot. That night we had Chinese. I said, "How was your day?" And she said, "Fucking fruit flies." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "How was your day?" And I said, "Milton Hilton asked Deborah to marry him." And she said, "That's nice." And then, "Who's Deborah?" And I said, "I don't know." That night I lay in bed and stared at the stars. We were remodeling at the time. Our bedroom had no roof. And I thought about how I did nothing, how something terrible was happening, and I did nothing. And I wondered if a better version of me might have acted less cowardly. In the following days and months and years, I often pondered this un-me, an un-me who was gracious to my wife when I was callous, and patient with my students when I was irritable. I thought about this man every time I meant to say, I love you, but instead I said, don't touch that. Every time I meant to say, yes, but instead I said,
yes?
Every time I meant to say, everything's going to be okay, but instead I said nothing. If I tell you I can't count all the times I've made the wrong call, chosen the wrong words, taken the wrong path, please know I'm not saying it to be modest about my counting skills, which I assure you are more than adequate. But if there was another me, an opposite, someone who did do all the right things, well, I figured that guy could really be something. Dr. Heslein had written in detail about an anti-universe that counter-resembles our own, balancing us, neutralizing us, receiving our excess energy and converting it to anti-energy. The braver, wiser, better un-me would live there, as would the uns of everybody who ever existed. Everything the anti-universe is would fit neatly into the crevices of everything we are not, like two halves of an English muffin. It would have the solutions to our problems, and it would inspire us to become a better un-them. And now, having finally raised the capital, Dr. Heslein was assembling a team of physicists and engineers to design and build the door that would take us there. He asked me whether I wanted to be a part of history if I wasn't too busy throwing words at handfuls of bored undergrads. I didn't even have to think about it. Work began on the anti-door that fall, under the assumption that while we were constructing a door that opens in, scientists in the opposite universe would be building a corresponding door that opens out. Because logic. My first day on the job, Jessica insisted on walking me to the metro stop. She said, be careful with all those complex theoretical equations, okay? Some of them have sharp corners. And I said, I'll be sure to wear gloves. For real, though, you're playing with the fundamentals of time and space. Don't create some sort of paradoxical pocket universe in which you were never born, because I still need you to clean the garage. And I said, your concern is touching. And she said, I was joking. I'm sorry, I'm nervous. And I said, don't be. It's bad for the baby. I kissed her on the forehead. She said, seriously, though, when you get back, you'll clean the garage? Of course, the universe is not black and white. And opposites turned out to be a little more fluid than we anticipated. The opposite of a dog can be a cat, or a different dog, or nothing at all, the absence of dog. I should iterate that this is an oversimplification of the math, but it is emblematic of the basic principle. Here are a few more examples. Example: I will not go out today. Possible opposites: I will go out today. I will not stay in today. I will stay in today. I will stay in every day. Example: my mother. Possible opposites: my father. My wife. My unborn child. My mother. My mother is dead. Example: I don't say, I love you. Possible opposites: I say, I love you. I don't say, I hate you. You don't say, you love me. I don't say, I love you. I don't even think it. Note that in the last example, in 3 out of 4 cases, the opposite of silence is silence. We had announced with great fanfare a new era of balance and understanding. But the more tests we ran, the less certain we could be about what was on the other side of the door we had just spent 8 months building. What if you walked through the anti-door and gravity lifted you off the ground and hurled you into outer space? What if the oxygen on the other side of the door was toxic? If there were no piranhas in the room you left, would you walk into a room full of piranhas? Or worst of all, what if the world on the other side of the door was no better or worse than our own, just different? What if it was just as heavy with war and famine and iniquity and cowardice? But Frank and Felicity Fielding and their foundation were not interested in what-ifs. They were interested in results. And since we had none to offer, they cut funding. and I returned to the unglamorous life of being a minor annoyance for hungover teens, and a husband, and eventually, presumably, a father. One afternoon, after a particularly ill-received performance of my lecture, Matter, Does It Matter?, I returned to my modest office on the fourth floor of the science building to discover that the cramped, poorly lit space the university had seen fit to give me was even more overstuffed than usual. Sitting in my chair, with his feet up on the desk, was Carl Hesslein, and behind him, blocking the window facing the alley, the room's sole source of natural light, stood the anti-door. "Why is this here?" I asked, and Dr. Hesslein said, "You think I was just going to hand this over to Fielding Corp? They wouldn't even know what to do with it." And I said, "We don't even know what to do with it." And he said, "Just keep it here until I find a better hiding spot, okay?" And I said, "But what if someone sees it? What if one of my students wants to visit during office hours?" And he said, "Has that ever happened?" And I said, "Not historically, no, but I like the idea that someone could surprise me." And he said, "Just keep it for a few weeks. I promise you'll forget it's even here." Well, I didn't forget. The door was behind me while I graded papers. The door was behind me while I ate lunches at my desk, a series of sad salads from the campus cafeteria. Every day, the room seemed smaller, and the anti-door seemed larger. It was behind me when I got a call from Jessica, after she went to see the doctor about the baby that wouldn't come out after a year and a half. "The doctor thinks it might be psychosomatic," she said. "He thinks maybe I subconsciously don't believe I'm ready for the baby." And I said, "Really? What do you think?" And she said, "Well, I think I'm ready, but maybe I'm sensing that you're not ready." "What do you mean I'm not ready? I'm ready." There was a pause, and she said, "I don't think you've really come to terms with the fact that everything's going to change once the baby gets here. Everything we were, our independent selves, our careers, all the things that mattered to us." And I said, "What makes you think I'm not ready for that?" She sighed and said, "I don't know, Yanni." And I said, "I promise you, the baby is going to come, and it's going to be the most amazing thing that ever happened to us. And we are going to be wonderful parents, but until that happens, why don't we try to enjoy this extra time we have before everything changes?" And she said, "See, this is what I mean about you not being ready." And I didn't say anything. And she said, "I'm sorry, Yanni." And I said, "We'll talk about this when I get home." And she said, "Okay, Yanni." I hung up the phone, and the door was behind me, and I spun around to look at it. And I rested my hand on the knob, and I turned the knob, and I opened the anti-door, and I walked through it. As soon as I crossed the threshold, I stumbled into a pool of water. I fell on all fours and spat out blood. I had swallowed a tooth. I squinted as my eyes adjusted to the new light. As far as I could tell, it was the same cramped office I had just come from, but with 6 inches of water in it. An incredibly handsome man, in a dark blue corduroy coat, was staring at me. I looked at the name on the office door. "You're Jonathan Beckerman," I said. And he said, "No doy. I don't know how you got in my office, guy, but you want to watch a video of me shooting hoops? I'm real skilled at shooting hoops." I said, "You're the opposite of me." And he said, "Shut up, you're the opposite of me." And I said, "Yes, both those things are true." And he said, "Shut up, neither of those things is true." And I thought, Jesus, this guy's a pain in the ass. Then he said, "Hey, I don't know what your deal is, guy, but you want to come over for dinner? My wife's a really good cook. Plus, she's a total babe." We walked to his house. The streets were flooded, and the other Jonathan made fun of me for not bringing my boots. Everywhere, people were shouting and dropping large electronic appliances at windows. Horrifying bats fluttered from lamppost to lamppost. Jonathan lived in a water-damaged mansion in the middle of a river. He kicked down the front door and shouted into the kitchen, "Jekka, I found this guy. He wants dinner." And I said, "My name is Yanni. I work at the university with your husband." The first thing I noticed about Jekka Beckerman was how very not pregnant she was. She wiped her hand on her apron and smiled widely as she offered it to me. "It's so nice to meet you," she said. "Dinner will be ready in a minute." It was the best meal I'd had in years. Jekka told us about the research she'd been doing on four-winged hummingbirds. "Technically, they're not really birds," she said. "We don't know what they are, but check out these migratory patterns." I could barely follow her, she talked so quickly. She flitted wildly between ideas and knocked over several glasses of wine. "If the field test doesn't work, I'll die. I will actually literally fall over dead and stay dead for the rest of my life. But if it does work, oh, Yanni, if it does work, it's too good to say out loud." While Yonatan washed the dishes, I bored his wife with stories of my own career. At one point, I must have reminded her of something else because she bit her lower lip and said, "Do you like earthquakes?" And I said, "Sure, which is true. Earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes. I'd like any situation where all of a sudden everything changes and the rules don't apply. I love an emergency." And Jekka said, "You want to know a secret? I do too." I walked back to Yonatan's campus, returned through the anti-door to my office, and took the metro home. My wife was in the living room, and I kissed her hard on the mouth, and I said, "Hey, beautiful, tell me something interesting about fruit flies." Jessica looked at me and said, "Yanni, they're fucking fruit flies." I started dipping into the world on the other side of the anti-door every day between classes, each time spitting out a new tooth and shoving it into my pocket so Jekka could sew it back into my mouth later. I became an expert at navigating my way through the opposite Beckerman's neighborhood and would try to beat my time from the campus to their house. 30 minutes, 20 minutes. This new universe I had discovered was exciting and terrifying and romantic as anything that's one tends to be all three. You walk through the anti-door, and suddenly you're a different person. Something is lost, and something is gained. Something is forgotten, and something is found. You reach into your pocket, you pull out a watch that wasn't there before, a photograph of a girl you don't recognize, the business card of a man you've never met. On my birthday, Jekka baked me an Earth Day quake, a confectionery disaster littered with little green candy men diving for cover under a split cookie crust. We sat together at one of Jonathan's basketball games. The court was on the top of a hill, so they wouldn't have to play in the water. I leaned in close to the woman who was the opposite of my wife and whispered, "He's really very good." Jekka smiled. "Isn't he? I was going to make cupcakes, but for some reason I didn't." I said, "That's okay. I can never eat cupcakes without feeling guilty." She said, "Yonatan's the same way." And I knew that one of us was lying. I asked her about her field test. Her eyes sank and then flickered, and she asked me what I was doing for New Year's. "Yonatan has to stay at the office and grade papers. Why don't you come over? I don't want to be alone." When I told Jessica I had to stay at the office and grade papers over New Year's, she took it harder than I expected. "Don't make me go to that party by myself," she said. And I said, "You'll be fine." She said, "But guess what? I'm baking a pie. I never bake." And I said, "Save me a slice." Jessica used to say "guess what" a lot because, one, she thought it was cute, and, two, she was a scientist. And scientists, she claimed, should always be guessing what. When she was in a playful mood, she would say, "Guess what? You are my husband. And guess what? I love you. And guess what? You are so adorable. I just want to punch you in the face." And when she thought I needed cheering up, she would say, "Guess what?" And I would say, "What?" And she would say, "I think you're wonderful. And I'm so proud of you." More often, however, she would use it as a rejoinder, as in, "Guess what? You forgot to do the dishes." Or, "Guess what? Someone left his shoes in the middle of the living room for his pregnant wife to trip over." On New Year's, Jekka and I stood in the kitchen, drinking wine and listening to the radio. Yonatan had thrown the TV out the window. There was a war in some country that I was pretty sure didn't exist in my universe. Jekka leaned against the sink and bit her lower lip, which was something she often did right before asking me a question. "When did you know you wanted to be a scientist?" she asked. And I told her my How I Became Interested in Science story. Yanni Beckerman's How I Became Interested in Science story. When I was in fourth grade, Peter Weiss returned from a family vacation in Germany with a horrifying cough and a contagious fever that splattered across the class like a Jackson Pollock painting. As it turned out, every single Gentile in the class got sick. All the blonde-haired Smiths and Vanderwilts disappeared, while the Rosenbergs and Cohens somehow seemed stronger, as if we were nourished by the absence of our classmates, like a garden suddenly free of weeds. Eventually, doctors figured out that Peter Weiss got infected by residual toxins at a concentration camp he visited. And all the Jews in the class, grandchildren of survivors, had inherited DNA immunized due to years of exposure. And that's when I realized that science is constantly happening all around us. Every other subject is static. Brutus will have always betrayed Caesar. One and one will always make two. And when two vowels go a-walking, the first one will always do the talking. But in science, we're constantly making new discoveries. We're the last pioneers. Jekka looked at me and bit her lower lip. And I could tell she wanted to ask me something, so I said, "What?" And she said, "When you walk through the anti-door, does it make you happier?" "I'm always happy to see you," I said. And she said, "Yeah, but I was thinking, say I'm at one-third happiness capacity. If I were to walk through the door, do I all of a sudden become two-thirds happy?" "I guess so," I said. "Double your happiness." And she said, "But that's the problem. I don't know how happy I am. For all I know, I could be at 75% happiness. And if I went through the door, I'd suddenly get knocked down at 25. I don't know what would be sadder, that I would now be a third as happy as I was before, or the realization that what I was before, that is to say what I am now, is three-quarters as happy as I could possibly get. What if I was 0% happy, and I walked through the door to find that 100% happy still isn't all that happy? What then?" And I started to say, "That's not actually," but she was really worked up. And then all of a sudden it was almost midnight, and I said, "Happy New," and the second hand on my watch quivered, and all of a sudden it was midnight, and we were kissing. The people on the radio were cheering, and I heard explosions in the distance, and I opened my eyes while I kissed her, and I saw a four-winged hummingbird at the window, and everything was too, too beautiful. Then, all of a sudden, midnight was over, and I felt deeply ashamed. It was midnight in 1 second, which is pretty much as far from midnight as you can get without going backward. I said, "Well, I should..." And she said, "No, please. Stay with me. Just for a little bit." Perhaps a better me would have done the right thing and left, or a worse me wouldn't have worried about it, just indulged in the transgression. But I am only as good as I am, and I could only do what the person as good as I am could do. A statue isn't built from the ground up. It's chiseled out of a block of marble, and I often wonder if we aren't likewise shaped by the qualities we lack, outlined by the empty space where the marble used to be. I'll be sitting on a train. I'll be lying awake in bed. I'll be watching a movie. I'll be laughing. And then all of a sudden, I'll be struck by the paralyzing truth. It's not what we do that makes us who we are. It's what we don't do that defines us. I took the metro back to Jonathan's campus and slid my key into the door of his office. When I re-entered my own universe, the room was flooded. I must have left the anti-door open. It was a long walk home. I crawled into bed, and Jessica was half awake, and she whispered, "Hey." I said, "Hey there." She pointed to her cheek, and I kissed her. And I asked, "How was the party?" And she said, "Boring. I wish you'd been there." And I said, "I'm sorry." She said, "I can't talk to people. I have too many teeth in my mouth. All the words come out wrong. I keep growing new teeth. It's really weird. Do you think it could be a side effect of the pregnancy? And I said, I don't know. We lay in bed and looked at the stars. We were fumigating the house. The bed was outside. And Jessica said, I missed you. I said, have you ever wondered what it's like to go through the anti-door? And she mumbled, sometimes. And she fell asleep. The next morning, my cell phone woke us up early, and Jessica shouted, turn that fucking thing off. It was Dr. Hessline's assistant, and the ringtone was Mahler's Uptempo March, My Baby Takes the Morning, Ludwigsbahn. She said, Yanni, it's Carl. He's dead. And I said, oh my God, is he okay? And she said, yeah, well, he's dead, so no. Carl had left the faucet running in his house overnight. The whole building had filled up with water, and he drowned in his sleep. We went to the funeral and the Shiva call. I said some very nice and accurate things. Jessica squeezed my hand lovingly. But the whole time, all I was thinking was, I have the anti-door in my office, and now nobody knows about it but me. I visited Jekka more. We made love in the bed she shared with her husband, the opposite of the bed I shared with my wife, and since we were each the opposite of the other one's spouse, I allowed myself to be convinced, no, I convinced myself, that mathematically, this was a neutral act. One day, after performing a neutral act, I returned through the anti-door to my office. The room was now half full of water, and Dr. Hessline was sitting on my desk, his feet on my chair. And he pointed at the door to the hallway and said, Yanni, I want for this door to be by you hidden kept. Just until this happens, I will find a place worse. And I said, this isn't right. This happened already. You're dead. In this universe, you're dead. Dr. Hessline nodded solemnly. This was afraid I would happen. I also nodded solemnly, pretending I understood what he was talking about. He grabbed a legal pad and doodled out a diagram. I wouldn't be lying if I didn't say I wasn't concerned. He paused, then concentrated on his words. When I will leave the anti-door with you, no. When I left the anti-door with you, I was hoping you would use it. But I thought you could travel back and forth between universes, like a beam of light bouncing repeatedly between two parallel mirrors. Instead, you've fallen through them, like a light hitting two mirrors at a diagonal, skipping across them infinitely. You understand? You don't come back to the same place you came from. Wanting proof, I grabbed a familiar book, Milton Hilton. I turned to a page I knew well, the one where Hilton asked Deborah to marry him. It now said, particles, particles, everywhere, particles. Also, Deborah, I love you, but I think I need to be alone for a little bit. Things with Jekka got more complicated. The more I visited her, the more trouble we had communicating. She was depressed. She hated her husband. I would try to tell her, things will get better, but it came out as, nothing didn't get worse. One day over takeout, she told me she didn't love me. I didn't know if she meant exactly that or the opposite. She told me she was pregnant. All I could say was, wow, which is mom upside down. I crossed the street and crawled through the anti-door. Dr. Hessline was standing on the ceiling of my office, crying and laughing at the same time. Tears were flowing up into his eyes. He shouted at me, Yanni, everything was always a mistake. You are so wonderfully unapologetic. Can you never not unforgive me? I spat out a tooth. My house was so far away, and it rained the whole walk back. Jessica was in the living room, glaring, horrified at our newborn baby son. I said, it's beautiful. She didn't say anything. So I said again, he's beautiful. She said, I can't stop cooking. I don't know why. I can't stop cooking food, and I can't close my mouth because of all my teeth, and I don't know what's happening to me, and I don't know what's happening to us, and I've never been more scared. I wanted to say, everything's going to be okay. But instead what I said was nothing. She said, you're cheating on me. And I didn't say anything. And she said, that was a question. Are you cheating on me? and I didn't say anything. And she said, if you're cheating on me, don't say anything. And I didn't say anything. Guess what? She said, I hate you. And I said, I probably could have guessed that. I almost left, she said. I almost took the baby and left, but I love you too much. And I said, you almost left? And she said, yeah, but I didn't. I ran for what felt like hours through the waterlogged streets, racing past overturned cars and disgusting birds and billboards advertising Milton Hilton's new book, Deborah, I'm Sorry, Please Take Me Back. My keys wouldn't unlock my office, so I kicked down the door and dove through the anti-door directly into the Beckerman's kitchen, where Jonathan was drinking milk and rum and staring at the wall. What happened? I said. And he held up a note. I almost stayed, but I didn't. I sat next to him, and neither of us said anything for a while. I said, do you remember several years ago on the metro? I started over. Did you ever witness something terrible? He nodded. Did anything, I mean, how did you, I mean, I started over. What did you do to stop it? He shook his head. He had done nothing, just like me. He recalled the shouting, the fear. We recited in unison the passage of Milton Hilton that we had both read over and over, particles, particles, everywhere, particles. As near as we could figure out, the only thing different about his experience was that he didn't lie in bed awake, wondering what his opposite would have done. I thought again about what we used to say in the lab, how, as a general rule, the opposite of silence is silence. I said, what am I doing here? It was a rhetorical question, but I didn't give Jonathan much credit in knowing which questions are rhetorical department, so I was surprised when he didn't answer. There's an old joke my mother used to tell me about a rabbi and his student. What's purple, hangs on the wall, and sings? Asked the rabbi. And the student says, I don't know. What's purple, hangs on the wall, and sings? And the rabbi answers, a dead herring. But rabbi, a dead herring isn't purple. Well, you could paint it purple. But rabbi, a dead herring doesn't hang on the wall. Well, you could hang it on the wall. But rabbi, a dead herring definitely doesn't sing. Oh, that? That I just threw in to confuse you. Pause for laughter. It occurred to me that maybe I'd tried to push the edges of my universe too far. After all, we live in the real world. And in the real world, you can paint a dead herring purple, and you can hang it on the wall, but hard as you try, you can't make it sing. And I imagined that if I were in some other, better universe, there'd be someone who could tell me, it's okay, or, you'll get 'em next time, Tiger. Someone would tell me that all the stupid things I'd done, all my mistakes, they didn't matter. This someone would say that no matter what, she was proud of me, that I filled her heart with warmth, and that that's really the most you could hope for in life. To just, for an instant, make somebody else just a little bit happier. She would tell me that, guess what? Everything was going to be all right. But in this universe, there was just this empty room in this ugly house in this horrifying city, and there were two Jonathans there, and one of them turned to the other and said dully, do you want to shoot some hoops? We played a few games, and I was better than I expected. He beat me, of course, but not by a lot. I stole the ball a couple times and surprised myself by completing a layup. At one point, we watched the sun set over the river and light up the horizon. Jonathan took it in, this wedge of transcendent beauty separating the ugly day and the terrifying night. And I got really lucky and scored a three-pointer while he was crying.
Lies We Told Each Other.
A Partial List. Read by Kimiko Glenn.
And Raul Esparza. You look really familiar. Have I seen you somewhere before?
I never have more than two. Ree drinks.
Funny story. I actually make a really good boyfriend.
That's hilarious.
That is so interesting.
That is so funny.
That's really funny.
I really never have more than five. Ree drinks.
I basically had a double major.
I'm pretty much running the place.
I know what you mean.
Oh, yeah, I think I read that somewhere.
I love this song.
I love this song.
That is literally the craziest thing I've ever heard.
I literally can't eat any more of this.
I gotta get up early in the morning. I have this thing for work. I'm sorry I haven't called you. Things have been crazy.
Oh, I can't on Friday. I have a thing on Friday. Just some friends, seeing some friends.
I wrote this song in like 5 minutes. It's not very good.
I honestly never think about him anymore. Ree Blake.
More than 10, but fewer than 20, regarding women.
It's this dumb work party. If you don't want to go, I won't hold it against you.
No, that sounds like a lot of fun.
You were the handsomest guy there. No, I'm serious.
Yeah, they seem really cool, regarding work friends.
I love you too.
I've never felt like this before.
This moment, right here, is the happiest moment of my life.
Yes.
Yeah. No.
Definitely.
I love them, Ree-earrings.
It's delicious, regarding soup.
I just feel like we get each other in a way most couples don't.
I also feel that way. Exactly.
I was listening.
I didn't even notice her.
Just a guy I work with.
You're reading too much into things.
He's like a brother. It would just be weird.
I've never thought of her in that way.
Well, that's really wonderful. No, I'm not being passive-aggressive. I really think it's wonderful. I don't know what tone you're talking about. I'm telling you, it's wonderful.
I love your friends. You know I love your friends.
What are you talking about? You're great at parties.
I didn't notice, regarding weight gain. No, I'm telling you, you look exactly the same to me.
I told you red, Ree-wine. I definitely said red.
I checked the weather before we left.
I didn't see your text until I was already on my way home.
They wanted to be just the guys, no girlfriends. I think it's stupid, personally, but what can you do? I'll tell them you said that.
You don't need to apologize to me.
I think the most important thing is honesty.
It's fine.
Fine.
It's really fine. I told you it's fine. I'm fine.
Of course I'm happy for you, regarding promotion. I'm thrilled.
I can listen and check my emails at the same time.
I don't keep track of those things the way you do, regarding who won argument. I do trust you, regarding Blake. Okay, you're right. I am not just saying that so you'll shut up. Do you know how degrading that is?
She seems really nice. I like her.
It doesn't bother me.
Just do whatever you want. I don't have an opinion one way or the other.
It was just coffee.
I think you're overreacting.
I'm sorry.
I had to work late. I told you I was at work. Why would I lie about being at work? I don't understand you. I actually have no idea what you're talking about. I really don't. Truly. This, whatever this is, it's all in your head.
You don't know me at all. I didn't mean it like that.
I don't deserve this.
I'm just thinking, what's going to be best for you?
All I want is for you to be happy. That's all I want.
I think maybe the problem is I love you too much. Could that be the problem?
Once everything settles down at work, things will get easier with us.
If you would just come home, we could talk about this like adults.
That is so mean. I do not have one foot out the door.
Damn it, we can make this work. I want to make this work. I am dedicated to making this work.
I actually think that fight was a really good fight for us as a couple.
I am never going to hurt you like that again.
I love you.
I love you too.
These are facts. Read by Will Brill. West fucked his foot up real bad his first day on the beach. God fucking damn it. And of course this would happen, and what a way to start the fucking week. It's not even as if he was doing anything, really. He was just fucking standing there, just chilling, knee-deep in the water, and trying to take it easy like a real honest-to-God person on vacation would. He was just starting to get comfortable for, like, maybe the first time in his whole fucking life when a rogue wave poured some rocks and shells and probably even some broken glass right onto his foot and scraped it up something ridiculous, covering it in all sorts of bruises and bumps so that it looked like a topographical map of God knows what, each gash and cut representing a river or a tributary or a mountain range or whatever the fuck they've got on topographical maps these days. This was Friday, or as they called it in Puerto Vallarta, Friday, because everyone at the resort spoke English. Wes didn't even attempt to pull out any of his 8 years rusty high school Spanish, although sometimes after the bartender gave him una cerveza, he would say, merci beaucoup, because that was his idea of a real funny joke. It was funny because the bartenders all spoke English anyway, and you know what, if he has to explain it to you, it's not even worth it. The good news was that even with a fucked up foot, Wes could still do what he really wanted to do, which was sit on the beach and drink beers all day and look at the water. In fact, the foot was a blessing in disguise because it meant he didn't have to do anything he didn't want to. His father or his father's current wife would say, hey, you want to go into town? Or you want to look at some ruins? Or you want to go on a boat? And Wes would wince and say, yeah, I'd really love to, but the foot. It was a conversation piece, really. Good-looking American chicas would come up to him and say, hey, what happened to your foot? And he could respond, better question, what happened to our society to make it so we view damaged things as somehow incomplete? On the contrary, I, for one, believe it is our damage that makes us whole. And then he could have sex with them. Of course, that never actually happened, not while you were there, but as Wes told you repeatedly, that's just because you were there. No girl's gonna come up and talk to me when I've got another girl sitting right next to me. I mean, that's just common sense. You would ask him if he wanted you to leave, and West would shrug and say, it's a free country. And then, remembering he was in Mexico, he would add, wait, it is, right? You didn't get to the resort until Saturday. You told your parents you couldn't fly out with them on Friday because Friday was Megan Doherty's graduation party, but in fact, you didn't go to Megan's party. You stayed home. You drew a bath for yourself, which at the time felt so sophisticated and adult. As a child, you often took baths, but this time you drew a bath. A bath was drawn. And as if that weren't enough, you lit a candle. A candle. And you pulled your parents' turntable into the bathroom and played a Joni Mitchell record. Which one? It doesn't matter. It was Blue. It doesn't matter. And you laugh about it now, but at the time, it all felt so significant. You were done with high school forever, and soon they would ship you off to college in Boston, where you would forget about all the friends and enemies you had in high school, all the things that were so important, all the inside jokes. Every 7 years, the cells in our bodies completely replace themselves, and we become entirely different people. Sitting in the bath, listening to California, you thought about your temporary cells, and you thought about how one day you would change. You would wake up one morning and all of a sudden everything would be different, and all the things that used to make you cry would make you roll your eyes, and all the things that used to make you roll your eyes would make you cry. But of course, that would all be many, many years from now. Incidentally, that thing about the new cells every 7 years, this was a fact. And if you looked, you could find it somewhere in your private book of facts you shared with no one, a spiral-bound blue notebook upon whose first page you wrote in shaky calligraphy, these are facts, and between whose covers hid hundreds of secrets as mundane and true as fact. Killer whales aren't really whales. They're dolphins. Your half-brother volunteered to meet you at the airport on Saturday. Your mom thought the whole family should go, but your father convinced her that you kids could use some catching up time. After all, how long had it been? After all, wasn't that the whole point?
West scrawled Heather in big block letters on a yellow legal pad and held the sign up at baggage claim where he waited for your arrival. It was 80% as a joke, the sign, but 20% because he was actually a little worried he wouldn't recognize you. It had been so long. After collecting your luggage and going through customs, you saw him. A very hairy hodgepodge of a person in cargo shorts and aviator sunglasses and an inexplicably long-sleeved t-shirt, as if it weren't about 100 degrees outside. Limping back and forth and picking at his beard, this mysterious other progeny of your father's looked somehow both older and younger than his own 26 years. Fact, he kind of looked like a homeless person. "Look at you," Wes said. And you said, "Look at you." And Wes said, "No, look at you, man. Just fucking look at you." Flying west out to Puerto Vallarta was your mother's idea. You had heard your parents arguing about it through the bedroom wall. "This is supposed to be a vacation," your father said. "I love West, but you know he's going to be a pain in the ass all week. I want Heather to know her brother." And here he was, this scrawny swizzle stick of a dude carrying your luggage from the elevator to the room. It was almost too much to see him again after all these years. Just the smell of him, it was almost too much. "I took the bed by the bathroom. I hope that's okay. I figure you might want to sleep by the window." "Some view," you said. Your room looked out over a construction site. The Crown Imperial was expanding. A crane was lifting a girder, moving it from one pile of girders to another pile of girders. One day, all this would be resort. West frowned and shifted his weight uncomfortably. "This room's pretty bougie. It stresses me out. You want to get down to the beach, get a drink?" "Oh, shit, you probably want to see your parents, huh?" You shrugged. "I see them all the time. This is supposed to be a vacation, right?" Wes thought that was hilarious. You found a pair of deck chairs in the sand under a big wooden umbrella and threw a towel over one of them. Your sort of brother grabbed a roaming hotel waiter and ordered 2 beers and a banana daiquiri. "They really try to sell you on the pineapple drinks," he said, "but I figured out that they make the pineapple drinks from, like, a sludge, and the banana drinks use real bananas." "Oh, I don't drink," you blurted out, as if he had asked you, as if anybody cared.
"Oh, good,"
Wes said a little too loudly. He winked at you, "Why?" then said to the waiter, "A virgin daiquiri for the lady," grinning warmly like it was some private joke the two of them shared. "You probably don't remember me at all," Wes said, lighting a cigarette. "What were you, like 6? You nodded. You didn't remember him, not really. And what you did remember, you weren't sure if you actually remembered it or if you just invented it. Cobbled together a brother from the elliptical stories your parents told and the worried glances they'd share whenever his name came up. "Shouting," you said. "I remember a lot of shouting."
"Yeah," he laughed. "Me too."
You squinted at the sun bouncing off the water. "You want to go in the ocean?"
"Nah, you go ahead," he said between drags of his cigarette. "I'll watch."
And you did. And he did. You met your parents for dinner at the hotel restaurant.
"It looks like you already got some sun, Heather," your dad said. "I hope you were wearing sunscreen."
"How's your foot?" your mom asked. And West answered,
"Well, it's fucked, June." Your dad crossed his arms and said, "Should we ask the front desk to call a doctor?"
And West said, "No, Dad, I'll be fine, but your display of paternal compassion has been noted by all." Your mother frowned sympathetically. "Well, hopefully it doesn't ruin the whole trip for you." After dinner, you walked your mom back to her room. She held your hand and smiled at you warmly, and you privately wondered how many times in the next few months before you left for college she would hold your hand and smile at you warmly. You don't mind sharing a room with West, do you? And you said, "No, Mom," like it was nothing. Like, why would she even have to ask? You washed your face and got into bed. You pulled a book out of your bag.
"What are you reading?" West asked.
"Oh, it's just this dumb book about these high school girls in New York."
"Is it any good?" You blushed.
"No, but I want to know what happens."
"Well, I'm bored," he said. "I'm going to go downstairs, get a drink. You want to come?"
At the resort bar, West regaled you with tales of adventure. The time he found a whole room's worth of furniture just lying by the side of the road. The party he crashed where he had sex with that guitar player's girlfriend. The time he got bedbugs somehow. When he felt the bar was getting really bougie all of a sudden, he took you out for a limp along the beach. So, bring me up to the present. You got a boyfriend? You shook your head. Why not? You're a good-looking girl. I don't know, you said. I feel like there were guys who wanted me to be their girlfriend. I just never met a guy who I thought was worth it. Worth what? West asked, and you shrugged. I don't know. It? All of it? I actually think that's the right idea, he said. Take your time. A lot of teens these days are too eager to grow up. You laughed. Oh, yeah? Is that a true fact about teens? He smiled self-consciously. I don't know. You're the teen, you tell me. I guess you're right, he said. But I don't think that, like, being in relationships and having sex is necessarily the same thing as growing up, you know? Like, growing up can mean a lot of things. See, now that's an astute observation, and it also tells me why you never had a boyfriend. What's that supposed to mean? You're too smart for high school boys. You must have gotten your smarts from your mom's side. Must have, you said. Definitely didn't get it from my dad, the clinical psychologist. Nah, don't be fooled by his fancy job, Heather. I promise you, that asshole's as dumb as they come. For a moment you debated whether to poke at this open sore, and then you wondered if your desire to poke at open sores was something you got from your dad, the clinical psychologist. Then Wes said, "What the fuck is that thing?" You looked up. About 10 yards down the beach was a dog, some sort of terrier mutt, flinching and panting in the sand. Wes raced ahead to get a better look. "Oh, shit. Is he okay? Hey, are you all right, guy?" The dog whimpered. "Shit. This dog is super fucked up. I think it's like having a seizure or some shit." "Well, don't touch it," you said as Wes scooped the dog up into his arms and started limping back toward the resort. "Be careful," you shouted. "That dog could have rabies or something." You followed your brother through the lobby of the Crown Imperial. "Sir, you can't bring that animal in here. Sir, please." Wes dumped the dog on the front desk. "We found this guy on the beach. I think he's really hurt," he said. "You gotta do something." The dog had stopped shaking and was now just lying on the counter, whimpering and drooling. And the concierge said, "Sir, sir." And Wes said, "Don't fucking sir me. This dog needs medical fucking attention." And the man asked, "Is this your dog?" Wes threw his arms up and paced an angry little circle. "No, it's not my dog. I told you, does anyone here speak fucking English?" People were starting to stare. A group of fratty-looking college guys, an older couple, a man with his kid. You said, "Calm down, West." And the concierge looked at you and said, "Can you please tell him to calm down?" As if you hadn't just done exactly that. "Is there like a dog doctor you can call? Does Mexico have fucking animal doctors or what?" The concierge was trying to stay calm himself. "Sir, the hotel has a policy?" West shouted. "Can you give him some fucking water or something at least? Jesus Christ." Now the man with the kid was yelling. "Hey, why don't you watch your language, huh? Watch my language. This dog is gonna fucking die." Then immediately, "I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry about the language." By now the concierge's boss had come out and said, "Sir, we have called animal services. They are on their way. Would you like to wait for them with the animal?" West exhaled. "Yeah. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it." "Okay. But he can't stay in here. We'll move him out front, okay?" "Yeah. Hey, look, I'm sorry about before when I said, does anyone here speak English?" "It's okay. Everyone speaks English great here, but you shouldn't have to. It's your country. But everyone speaks English great. I was being a dick in the heat of the moment, you know?" The man shook his head. "I understand you are upset. It's not a problem, sir." West looked at his name tag. "Jorge, you're a fucking stand-up guy. Don't let anyone tell you any different." Jorge nodded. "Okay, sir." Two hotel employees carefully wrapped the dog in a Crown Imperial towel and carried him toward the front entrance. You followed them out and passed the man with the kid. "Hey, listen," the man said. "I know you're really upset about the dog, but this is a family resort. You think you could do me a favor and go easy on the cuss words?" "Yeah, I know," Wes said. "Sorry, I'm just... fuck. Sorry. I'm sorry." The two bellhops laid the dog out on the steps in front of the building. Wes sat next to it and scratched its stomach. "Hang in there, buddy," he said. He looked at you. "Are you cold?" You shook your head. "You weren't, not really." A cab pulled up and a couple flailed out, drunk.
"Oh my God, is that your dog?" the woman asked,
and her husband said, "Come on, Amy, keep walking." West shook his head.